I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today, we're talking about different ways of seeing a city. First, we'll find out how cities can provide unique creative experiences for their visitors from Alex Patakos, co-editor of a new book called Creative Tourism, A Global Conversation. In it, he and others describe how cities can offer customized, authentic, and meaningful experiences to their visitors that are tied to the uniqueness and the spirit of a place. And we'll revisit an earlier conversation I had with Fred Dust. In his books on London and New York, Fred attempts to teach his readers how to look at the world with eyes open by showing them the intimacies of these cities that can be easily missed. All that plus the latest news from Plan Edison coming up on today's Smart City, right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Alex Patakos is known in some circles as Dr. Meaning. He is passionate about helping people find deeper, authentic meaning in their everyday lives and work. And he's turned that same meaningful eye to the idea of place. Last year, he led a conference, the Santa Fe and UNESCO International Conference on Creative Tourism. From the proceedings came a book, Creative Tourism, A Global Conversation. Alex, what is creative tourism?
There are a number of definitions that are out there. The one that we used not only as the foundation for the book, and the definition that was used at that time by the Planning Committee was that creative tourism is tourism directed toward an engaged and authentic experience with participative learning in the arts, heritage, or special character of a place. So the key elements there, of course, are one, that it be an authentic experience. There's obviously a creative dimension to it in terms of how one engages the tourist by the tourism provider. And then, of course, the engagement has to be meaningful.
How do you know when something is authentic? I mean, there are a lot of, as you know, there are a lot of debates on this subject. So tell me how you define authentic experience.
In the context of creative tourism, of course, a major part of authenticity revolves around who the indigenous populations are that really represent the culture and the character and the spirit of a place, a location. Now, with the world, obviously, the global economy and the shifts in population migration and so forth, authenticity oftentimes also somewhat changes as different communities, different jurisdictions start to evolve or change depending on immigration patterns and so forth. But the basic idea is that when people go and they're attracted to a place, they're interested in what that place represents. And a large part of the book and a large part of this conference, of course, dealt with the authentic notion that built around the spirit of a place. And, you know, if you're going to the Southwest in the United States, you want to feel that you're not in Paris, France, that you are, in fact, in the southwestern part of the United States. And that becomes manifest in things like having experiences with Native Americans, with, say, the cowboy culture, the Hispanic culture of the Southwest. If we go to other places that are more multicultural, maybe their particular brand or their particular cultural values are a little more difficult to type, you still have to look at, well, what does this place represent? And that becomes a major question that economic community development policymakers need to identify, articulate, and then try to design that into their tourism experiences.
Well, let's take a place like Des Moines, Iowa. I don't associate any particular ethnic group with Des Moines, Iowa. I don't associate it with multiculturalism. That may be unfair. I'm not criticizing it. I'm just giving you an impression. Is creative tourism even available to a city like Des Moines, Iowa?
I don't know enough about Des Moines, Iowa specifically, but I can tell you this, that I know there are places in Iowa that represent elements of creative cities that myself, that I was unaware of. And for example, I mean, it's not just in terms of maybe the cultural experiences around, say, the agriculture, the use of the land of a place, but there actually are places in Iowa, for example, where literature is something that's become kind of a hub, and that people share stories and share their literary expertise and experiences. And so the issue, again, going back to what is creative tourism, is that Creative tourism also is differentiated from other types because it's trying to move away from the whole mass tourism movement, if you will, that has, over particularly the last 25 years, I think, has really almost killed tourism in a lot of ways because people end up saying, well, been there, done that, and so they don't really see, well, what is something that's unique to a community, say, is Des Moines, Iowa. Whichever community that we're looking at, it's really up to that community to identify, well, what is its heritage? What are the things that maybe it is either known for or would like to be known for? I mean, there are certain things that potentially, whether it's their spiritual base, whether it's the agricultural industrial base, whether it's something has to do with learning. So to make going to a place in Iowa more enchanting and more engaging, part of the creative tourism formula, if you will, is to try to find ways to engage people so that they do want to stop and they do want to learn more about that community. Because what I would like to say is that every community has the potential, just like every community has the potential to be a creative city or creative jurisdiction, but they have to define what that means for them. I mean,
so it doesn't have to be built around ethnic populations, indigenous populations. I mean, it can be built around local traditions, local industry. So it's really more about localism and distinctiveness rather than indigenous people or ethnicity. Is that fair?
Well, it's somewhat fair. I think that the idea is that obviously there are communities, there are jurisdictions that have the additional benefits of having ethnic types of opportunities to offer tourists. But you're absolutely right. And it's finding the uniqueness of the place. And if you have a community that it does have traditions that they would like to showcase and engage people, it doesn't mean that it has to be either ethnically grounded or racially grounded or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Let me just push you one more minute on this definition, because I think, like the definition of creative cities, it can be very hard to pin down. And so there are, let's say, a production of Shakespeare, which may take place in Chicago, and it may take place in Miami, and it may take place in Des Moines. Is that a foundation for creative tourism, or does this need to be, would you think about building creative tourism around the arts in a way that it's only those arts that are distinctive and local to a community around which you build creative tourism? Again, just in an effort, Alex, to understand your point of view on this.
I'm going to give you my point of view, which could be different than my co-editors and co-authors. The key to this, and again, you've got to look at all these different pieces that we try to describe and articulate in the book, which includes authenticity, which includes the whole notion of co-creation, that the tourist co-creates an experience. It's not just, you know, sitting back in a bus and passing by something and say, okay, on your right is some monument or whatever. It's the idea of being able to feel that what they're seeing and what they're experiencing is, in fact, an expression of creativity. And creativity is another word that it's sometimes abused and overused so much that everything is creative these days. And, of course, the notion of drawing people to a place, whether it's creating other types of creative industries in a locale or whether it's creative tourism, that's kind of almost one of the ways of determining whether or not what you're doing is on target. Because if a community, say, looks at something like some sort of a Shakespearean experience for people in one part of the country, the fact that it's maybe done better or maybe it's more recognized as being embedded in the value of, say, a place like Santa Fe, which has, you know, a world-class opera and has other theaters and so forth that are known already around the world, if in fact their uniqueness and if in fact it seems to be something that has some tie to the traditions of the place and it is in fact a manifestation of that local community, that's going to end up creating, one, a more authentic experience. Secondly, if you engage the tourist in this experience, so it's not just seeing a show as an audience member, but if there are ways of taking a theater and actually allowing people to be part of, say, understanding how a set is designed, maybe even helping to design a set. These are the kinds of things that are creative ways to engage people so that they actually learn more about, say, Shakespeare than just reading Shakespeare or seeing a play. So again, it's up to the creative potential that's involved in this whatever this endeavor is, whatever community is involved. It's also involved in how much can you engage people. I mean, it may be that going to one place, seeing the same, having the same type of experience is much more engaging and memorable and meaningful than going to a place that you'd expect people to go to, because there are some communities where people expect, I mean, they're just so rated highly in the arts and culture that's almost a no-brainer that you're expecting to see those things. But all of a sudden you have a surprise community that gives you something that's so unique that ends up becoming an engaging, memorable experience, and you want to go back or recommend that other people go there.
Give me a couple of examples of co-creation of experiences that you think have been relevant to the creative tourism experience.
Absolutely. Well, I'll start with one that's not in New Mexico, and then I'll share one in New Mexico, since this is, you know, where we had this conference. I'll give you an example. In Greece, and particularly in the island of Crete, there are a number of places. One in particular is mentioned in the book. It's called the Greco Farms. But there are a number of places in communities in Crete where you not only go to, say, have a wonderful Mediterranean diet dinner, but you actually go to places in a community and you go out and you, say, pick olives. You actually learn how to and help make olive oil. And you actually use the olive oil in helping to make the dinner with the people that are in this community. And so you don't just learn about or taste olive oil or go to a store or go to, you know, buy a bottle of olive oil in the community or at the airport. You actually learn, where does it come from? You know, how is it made? Actually make it. And so you co-create the experience, because part of the experience is not only learning about making olive oil, but you're also learning about that culture and why the olive oil making is part of that community spirit. And when you leave, I mean, now, and you do the same thing with wines and so forth. I mean, there's all types of food. I mean, in Crete, as one example, that's a place where you do a lot of engaging co-creation of the experience of making different types of foods that we hear about in the Cretan Mediterranean diet. And so that adds a tremendous amount of value to understanding where these products that you eat, consume, come from.
Yeah, that's a lovely, lovely example. And you said you had one from New Mexico.
Yeah, well, in New Mexico, there are many, many, of course, in the book, you know, we showcase New Mexico being the host city for this conference. But there are many experiences that, say, draw from not only the culture, which is basically an Anglo-Hispanic Native American culture in New Mexico, but there are many examples, again, similar to what I just described in Crete, where people, and there are photos as well as stories in the book about, say, you know, making different types of, say, food items like green and red chili and making different items for dinners. I mean, we have a number of great cooking schools here where the cooking schools opened up and make sure that they're offering opportunities for tourists to not just know, okay, well, this is the kind of product you want to buy to consume, but here's how you make it. We do the same thing with, say, the Native American arts and culture, where we had people learning, not just observing pottery as a finished product, but actually sitting with the artist and actually playing with the notion of making your own pottery, but this way you end up, nothing else, understand how difficult it is, but how creative an experience it is, and actually make some of your own products as part of the experience of interacting with a well-known Native American artist.
Who makes up the market, Alex, for creative tourism?
Well, I mean, that's a very, very, very good question, because obviously there are still going to be many, many people out there who want the traditional, you know, mass tourism experience, going to places, to museums, going to the Disneyland type of experience. There's more and more evidence that people, not just baby boomers and people who have gone through so many experiences in their life that they say, I've been there, done that, and they want something that's more authentic, more meaningful, more engaging for themselves. But there are more and more people, I think, that, you know, they want to get out, they want to do some things to learn about a place, to learn about people, to learn about experiences that help their own personal development. And so that's a major theme. So people who are interested in life as being more than just existing, they really want to transform themselves in some way. They want to enlighten and engage themselves in things that help their personal growth. Those are the kinds of people that want those kinds of experiences. And we're even starting to see say, cruise lines that are starting to offer things that are much more engaging and much more tapping into wherever they port they may stop, that are looking for places where some of the businesses locally actually engage people on the cruise in something that is more than just seeing something as a deadhead and just watching it as they pass by. And so there's a greater increase. Now, is it everybody right now? Of course not. But I think that there are more and more people, including families, that find creative tourism opportunities as something that is more active as opposed to passive. It's more engaging with, say, they and their children, spouses, partners that are doing things together, because those are more memorable, meaningful experiences rather than saying, I've been there, done that.
Yeah, and that resonates for me. I'm wondering if you know how big the market is or what percentage of the tourism market is looking for this creative tourism type of experience. Do you know? Do you have any idea?
At this point, I really don't, and I would hate to kind of guesstimate what the market would be like. I can tell you that it's growing, that it's evolving. I mean, even the notion of creative tourism, I mean, it's, you know, there's so many types of tourism out there. Besides the mass tourism, we hear about cultural tourism, geotourism, you know, sustainable tourism, you name it. And, you know, we're talking about creative tourism really can bring all of those together. But it's really the opportunity, if we're going to really think about creative cities, and this is the reason why UNESCO's Global Creative Cities Network was a sponsor of the conference and of the book, was really to make this initiative be something that can engage all these other types of tourist experiences, and then put that creative spin on it in such a way that, in fact, it will create a market, because we're recognizing, and I can just tell you just right now, and the book officially is just now starting to get some traction. We're officially launching it actually September 3rd at an event here in Santa Fe, and we're just introduced it at the UNESCO meeting in June. But the idea here is that the inquiries that we've been getting about creative tourism, it's really starting to engage the tourism professionals, because they want to say, well, if I want to differentiate between communities that I'm sending tourists, you know, potential our clients to, I want to send them to places that really resonate with their values. I think that portends to a growing market.
Well, this is an interesting question when you bring up the tourism industry, because it's basically driven by taxes on room nights. I mean, that's essentially the way we fund most tourism in the U.S. And so, you know, pretty quickly becomes a game of big events like conventions or sports events, festivals. Then we think about the big institutions, even the big cultural institutions. But so much of the creative tourism, for instance, when you start talking about co-creating experiences, and you described the ones in Greece and the making of the olive oil and so forth, those have to happen, I would assume, at fairly small, local, grassroots level. So how do you connect sort of big tourism with these sort of startup, small, grassroots, local efforts?
You know, there are several ways. I mean, and obviously one of the big agenda items for the future of creative tourism is to do exactly what you're saying. I mean, I think that there's a real potential here for those that are doing the mass tourist experience. Even, I mean, we're not taking away from people going to Washington, D.C. and going to the Smithsonian and so forth. There are so many places around the world where you're going to always have this mass tourism draw. But I think in terms of tourist professionals in communities around the world that are really looking at, okay, what's our point of difference? How can we re-energize the tourism magnet that we've relied on for so long? Because right now, as you know, with the economy, and most countries and provinces right now are taking a big hit. And so they're looking for creative ways of how do we bring tourism back to life, or how do we make sure that we don't have too much of the negative hit that we're getting because of economic conditions? So what can we make that's attractive? So if we can have a mass tourist experience, you know, it doesn't mean taking away museums and some of the large conventions and so forth, but how do we take, say, the convention? Because I know personally, having gone to many conventions in my life, if there are opportunities to attend a convention that also allow me the opportunity to go and learn something about a local community and culture, or to experience something by co-creating something along the lines that we've been talking about, that makes that conference in some cases much more memorable. As a matter of fact, I've had experiences where I've learned more from the community than I have from going to a convention. And so the idea here is that how can we marry those two? It's just it's an add-on. It's not taking anything away, but it's allowing people who want a more individualized, creative, engaging experience than just getting on a bus or just going to a museum alone. Doesn't take away from that. It's basically saying, how do we do that? So in the mass tourism context, there are many opportunities to be creative again to do that. But this also allows the local communities, the small players, to also figure out, well, how do I attract more people into my gallery? How do I get people to come into my restaurant? Because there are some restaurants that are, you know, I mean, going back to my Greek heritage, I mean, you know that, I mean, Greek restaurants, it's not so much about the food as it is the experience. That's the kind of thing that we're talking about here. So it's really allowing the small players as well as the large players. And that's, again, a major theme of this book and of this conference we just had, is really about how do we create a community of stakeholders that includes tourism providers and tourists in such a way that it makes it even more attractive.
What's the next frontier in creative tourism?
I think we've touched on a number of things. I mean, how do we take the notion of mass tourism and the opportunities that exist in communities of all sizes, jurisdictions of all sizes, in such a way that everything that we're doing is trying to make the tourist experience more meaningful, more engaging, more transformative, if you will? I think that's a challenge. And, you know, we just touched the surface, you know, the tip of the iceberg here in terms of how we can do that. You know, we had in this conference and in this book representatives from 16 countries. They're learning from each other. They're sharing best practices. But I'm not sure yet that we're totally ready for sharing next practices, because we're still trying to figure out what the best practices are.
Well, good point. If you're attempting to build a creative tourism strategy for your city from the ground up, where would you begin? What are the first questions you would ask and answer to get a creative tourism strategy started?
There's actually the chapter that I contributed to the book called Discovering the Deeper Meaning of Tourism actually has some suggestions on how to go about doing that. And, you know, it really is building upon, again, not just what exists in terms of doing a catalog of what are some of the tourist experiences that a jurisdiction community may have. I mean, it's amazing how many communities I've come across that don't even know what's out there in terms of either creative tourist experience or even some of the things that are maybe more passive and wouldn't be labeled creative tourism. So basically doing some sort of a first step is a catalog or an inventory of what is your jurisdiction doing to attract and engage tourists, and understanding that. And then aligning that with, okay, which of those experiences are in fact authentic, which of those are really reflect the tradition, the culture, maybe the ethnicity or the history of your community. That's a big piece, rather than just saying, okay, we're just going to go and we're going to make another theme park. And all we want to do is compete for who gets the next Six Flags, which, by the way, has enough trouble. And then look at what are some of the creative things that could be done with the inventory of tourist experiences that you already have. This is part of tapping into that creative economy, looking at the members of your own creative class locally and saying, okay, what can we do to make what we offer today even more creative and more engaging, more authentic, more reflective of our values and our community, you know, so that we have a point of difference. And it may be going to conferences like we had last fall. It may be developing, as we're going to do here in Santa Fe, a global database so that we can begin to share best practices. I mean, we have communities right now in the UNESCO Creative Cities Network, as well as those who want to be in that network from around the world, who are, if nothing else, learning from each other and trying to figure out, okay, can we apply some of the things that we saw in Santa Fe or in some other country in China or Japan and vice versa. So understanding, you know, some of those best practices and then trying to figure out how do we apply that within our local context, that's going to be a first thing. And then there are things on different levels. I mean, I think that tourism needs to be looked at from a policy perspective. So I think is if tourism is truly going to be part of your economic development engine, then your public policymakers need to articulate that, and they need to be consistent and really raise the flag, if you will, that tourism is going to be a major part of our economic development engine. Secondly, they need to really focus on managing things so that, again, having the inventory of what's available, ensuring that they learn how to create linkages across the different tourism providers and so forth, so that we don't either duplicate things in a way that's not productive, that we make sure that we fill in gaps, because it's amazing how many people come in here and they really don't know what each other's doing, and they could be almost down the block from each other. So understanding that and providing a coordinated, and as I say in my chapter, an integrated strategy around tourism so that people can go in, they say, oh, geez, I'd really like to try something about, learn something about Native Americans. I'd like to learn something about, you know, what it would be like to live on a ranch. Do you have an experience like that? I mean, and if you don't, then why not? Particularly if that's a major part of your history, your culture, your traditions.
Alex, it's been fun talking about your new book, Creative Tourism, A Global Conversation, How to Provide Unique Creative Experiences for Travelers Worldwide. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Carol. It was wonderful talking with you.
Alex Patakos is the author of numerous books. His latest is as co-editor of the book, Creative Tourism, A Global Conversation. For the latest in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
Endorsed by the Senate Judiciary Committee, Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor is on her way to the nation's highest court, and it's got some property owners shaking. What's got them worried is the precedent Sotomayor helped set in a 2006 case over the use of eminent domain in the name of economic development. A recent piece from the Christian Science Monitor looks at the history of that case, ruled upon after the controversial eminent domain case of Kelo versus New London, which established that local governments could use eminent domain for economic development that benefits the public. Sotomayor's role on a three-judge panel affirmed the constitutionality of a similar use of eminent domain in that 2006 case. And in recent confirmation hearings, she has defended her ruling on that case. A pro-eminent domain stance that could mean bad news for small property owners as cities try to revive their economies. Meanwhile, Chicagoans are trepidatiously broaching the prospect of hosting the 2016 Summer Olympics. The city is widely believed to be the favorite of four finalists for the event, but anti-Olympic sentiment is growing in the Windy City. Organizers have estimated that hosting the event would cost about $3.3 billion, but they say no city money would be required to pull it off. About $60 million in private funding has been raised so far, according to an article in the New York Times, but the economic recession has many in the city worried that private investments won't filter through and the balance will be left to the city and its taxpayers. And indeed, the gamble is already underway. The city recently agreed to invest $86 million to build the Olympic Village, months before an official 2016 host has even been chosen. Officials say private developers will come in and foot this $86 million bill, not to mention the $3.3 billion overall that will be required for the event. This has left many opponents asking, what if they don't? And if Chicago's $3.3 billion price tag sounds bad, brace yourself for what's facing Brazil. The country is going to be hosting the 2014 Soccer World Cup, and a recent article from the Associated Press looks at a report that estimates the total infrastructure investment related to the month-long event at more than $42 billion. The 12-city event will require new stadium development, the expansion of road and transit infrastructure, and broad improvements to public safety throughout the country. Despite the infrastructure focus of the work, the majority of spending will be directed at soccer stadia. And while many in the country hope for a positive outcome, there is still some concern that these will only serve as underused monuments to wasteful spending once a World Cup has come and gone. For Plan Edison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. Coming up in the second half of the show, Fred Dust of IDEO will talk about his hybrid of travel book and anthropological study that he calls A Field Guide for the Curious. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Another hello to our podcast listeners. You've probably heard us talk about our social networking site, My City. Well, we've added some new features to the site, including a widget for my Twitter stream and an embeddable Smart City audio player so you can add us to your blog or website. If you're not a member of Smart City, send an email to Scotty, the producer of Smart City, and he'll get you set up. The address is scotty@smartcityradio.com. I look forward to seeing you on the site, and now, on with the show. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. Fred Dust is partner and practice lead for IDEO, the global design and innovation firm. An architect by training, Fred leads multidisciplinary teams to create immersive, interactive spaces in diverse industries. He once collaborated with cartoonist Scott Adams to create Dilbert's Ultimate Cubicle, a whimsical concept for a modular cubicle that accommodates office workers' personal taste and work styles. But his latest project is an unusual book series called Eyes Open. They are a cross between travel books and anthropological studies of city life in New York and London. Fred calls them field guides for the curious. Fred, you and your colleagues at IDEO have produced a new set of books. Why the focus on cities?
What's interesting to think about in terms of IDEO is that IDEO is a design company that's been around, we've been around for about 20 years, and primarily we look at human behavior to kind of understand what you might design. And that's everything. It's from cell phones to cities to housing to, yeah, I mean, toothbrushes, you name it. And I guess the idea for us was, what can we learn about what people make for their cities, like what kinds of experiences they build that can actually tell us about cities and also tell us about the people that live there? So primarily that was the idea and the kind of impetus behind creating the Eyes Open guides. I sort of think of it as anthropology light, which is actually how it was described on Amazon, which I loved.
That's great. I love that too. What are you hoping your readers will get from Eyes Open?
Well, you know, it's interesting because they weren't developed to be here's the 50 most hip places, coolest places in New York. What they were really about was actually kind of helping people to go out into the city and kind of reminding them to look. I mean, that's the title. If you look at the same places you've been to, but you look at them kind of in a new light, you actually see really interesting things. So the locations were chosen primarily to kind of forefront really interesting things around people or really interesting things around the way an experience gets developed. So an example is we talked about the Upper East Side, but actually mostly what we were interested in was actually not so much what happens in the Upper East Side, but mostly the way people interact. There's an entry called Mothers of the Upper East Side, which is basically the way mothers and nannies have reshaped the neighborhood by kind of having so much kind of stroller traffic and activity there that's actually changed the way the neighborhood actually has been built and designed.
You say that it's designed to remind us to look. How do you encourage your colleagues and then certainly those of us who are not trained to look and to look deeper, to see more, to notice the things that we don't normally notice?
Well, there's a couple things, actually. I mean, our job is to do that, and we actually have people at IDEO who come from the, you know, anthropologists and psychologists and sociologists who are here to do that. But the reality is we try to get everyone at IDEO to kind of look with eyes open, and there's a few things that we do. And they may be actually counterintuitive. One thing that I always like to say to my designers and even to people in the world is when you travel and when you're out in the world, kind of pretend like you're traveling with your mother. When I travel with my mom basically talks to everybody, right? So she's like in a store and she wants to know everything. And like, she's kind of creating like, you know, really great bonds with the people who she's, you know, buying something with. And that's actually a really great tool to kind of learn more about your environment. So one thing that we try to do is kind of get people to ask a lot of questions and talk to the people who are in the places. So that's one thing. One of the things that actually really may be sort of counterintuitive is that we ask people to travel with cameras, which is sort of a funny thing because you think of cameras as kind of like a tourist tool. But if you've looked at the books, it's like filled with photography. And one of the things about cameras is that they help you look at things slightly differently. You know, you might kind of say, well, how do I frame something and start noticing something that's really different because of it? So little tools like that are really basic everyday things actually help us to kind of think about how to explore the environment in different ways.
I wonder sometimes, I always travel with a camera every day, all the time, and I take pictures almost every day. But sometimes I wonder, Fred, if the camera actually keeps me from noticing things. I mean, I get very focused on what it is I want to take a picture of, and sometimes I never have any people in my pictures. I'm not sure what that says about me. Perhaps your anthropologist could tell me. But I wonder if I miss the human interaction going on around me since people are rarely in my photos.
Well, you know, that's so interesting. So I actually just spent a couple weeks in Shanghai, and I traveled with a team, and we all as well travel with cameras. And what I noticed is that every single person notices different things. So there'll always be someone in a group who's primarily looking at people, you know, so like they're interested in the way someone's, you know, sweeping a sidewalk or the way someone's doing whatever in the street. They're noticing the moms with the strollers trying to kind of break through a crowd. Then there's another group that's just noticing like details. So what are the little things that are making something? And then there's someone else who's kind of framing the entire perspective. So it actually helps when you have more people often, because then you everybody gets different perspectives. But I think back to your original point about, does it actually stop you from seeing? I would say that you travel with a camera because it reminds you to notice. And so you're at least thinking, whereas most of the time we stop thinking. And so it actually kind of keeps in mind that you should be looking. So I think it's actually a good kind of little mental jog for us.
Good point. How do you start organizing your thoughts about cities as rich and diverse as New York and London? And how do you say something, Fred, that hasn't been said 1,000 times before?
It's, you know, well, first of all, it's really hard. And, you know, one of the things around, if you decide to do a kind of travel guide series, everybody says you have to start with New York and London. And when we kind of started out in that way and said, well, we'll do New York and London, we were like, oh, what are we going to say? You know, it's like basically what you're saying. We were like really terrified. But one of the things is that when you start to kind of look at cities at the detail level and look at things kind of like on the streets, you start to recognize that cities are really different from other cities and also really different from the way they're actually portrayed. And so New York and London were fascinating to look at because if you think about them in your mind, they're both major cities, probably the two cities that come to mind first. You know, if you stop for a moment, you're like, oh, New York and London, those are global cities that belong to everybody. And yet, when you start to look at them, especially pairing them, they're profoundly different cities. And so one thing that helps is to kind of look at cities in contrast to each other. Like, here are two really dense cities, but they respond to the density in really different ways. New York loves small spaces, building off of that, kind of fitting things into nooks and crannies. London actually deals with things a little bit more by timing and schedules. So they'll have things that pop up and then shut down over time, which allows for them to deal with the density. So comparison actually really helps a lot when we're looking at cities.
It's interesting you make that point about comparison. If you take simply London, what were the fresh insights that you think you were able to capture in your book that perhaps others have not?
There's a bunch of things, but I think one of the things that really pops out to me that was most interesting about London is that London really is a city that's about time. And I can't actually tell you what it is, although one of the reasons I think that might be the case is because of the density. The city changes by time of day in radical ways. So you think, you know, it's a market-based city. So there's like markets, and markets by nature are kind of time-based propositions. So they happen on Sunday morning or Sunday afternoon or Friday at 3. And so you see whole neighborhoods that shift based on kind of what's happening around timing. Also, I mean, as you know about London, this is kind of a weird thing to say, but it's obviously a big drinking city, right? So London on a Thursday and Friday night is insane. And London on a Saturday morning, profoundly different, right? It's like Friday night is like a war zone, or Saturday morning is like dead quiet. And it's, you know, everyone's been sleeping and sleeps until 1. Those kinds of time patterns was a really interesting thing to notice when you just sit and soak up the city. So it's things like that that we actually would kind of look at. One thing I would point, though, is that the idea was to kind of look at small movements or small things and see what the bigger themes were. So if we looked at markets, we could say, well, what is this telling us about the city and how does this actually shift the city?
And what were the bigger themes in New York that you uncovered?
You know, I've spent a ton of time in New York and I expected kind of not to be inspired by New York. And I got there and I was like, oh, you know, when you look at it again, it's an endlessly inspiring city. And I think the thing about New York that's interesting is that, frankly, it's a hard place to live. It's filled. I live in California. You know, California is an easy place to live. I think you're in Chicago.
Well, as long as gas stays cheap,
yeah,
it's an easy place to live.
Exactly. Well, I live in San Francisco, so it's a little different. I think LA could come to a standstill. But you know, you're in Chicago. Chicago's an easy place to live. Like, New York has quite a bit of constraints to be able to live in that city. And what's interesting is how creative people get around developing and designing around those constraints. So the classic one is size, right? Everything is all about how do you fit it into a compact space? And there's incredible pride in that. That's really pretty remarkable to see. So there's stores about it. There's just like tons of really interesting innovations. It is a city where every single place you go, there's something tucked into it. So my favorite example is, One of the big things that people have to get over is how expensive things are in New York. How do you like live and work in New York? And so we saw really interesting experiences. There's one place called BB Blessing that basically is a store, but because they couldn't afford the rent in their neighborhood, it's also a record store in the back. So basically a bunch of friends got together and said, oh, together we can afford the rent. So together they made a far more interesting experience by kind of basically hybridizing it because of the fact that they couldn't afford the rent otherwise. That constraint makes it a really interesting, I think, and exciting city because people are always having to design to get around things.
Where do you find these books in the bookstore? Are they in travel? Are they in anthropology? Are they in pop culture? Where are they?
You actually find them everywhere. And, you know, so the moment you have a book out there, you're like, where do you find them? So you kind of go out to sort of like see where they are. And like, you definitely see them in the travel section. I've actually, what's been really funny to me is that it's actually, it's less where in the bookstore, but what bookstores they've been showing up in. So we've been seeing them in a lot of independent bookstores. A lot of museums are taking them because I think, again, they're about looking. So I think that's actually a really interesting thing. So, but right now they're in travel, which I kind of like because I think it's actually just it's a really interesting take on how to think about travel, frankly.
It seems that travelers today really are as interested in discovering places like the Story Deli and Crumbs and Doilies in London that you wrote about as they are in touring the Dinosaur Hall at the National History Museum, which you also wrote about. I think you've done a really nice job of conveying the charm and excitement of these smaller places where day-to-day life unfolds. How did you curate the list? You must have started with something huge. How did you pare it down? What were your criteria?
It's interesting to think about, and if you look in the back of the book, we actually talk about how we made the book, because it's interesting to think about how you actually get a list like that. So we started by just kind of asking everybody in the world that we knew to send us the most interesting places. So we had a list of like 300 places that we culled down to, you know, about 100 that seemed like really interesting and intriguing, and went out to kind of just walk the streets and spend time with them. And what we saw over time is that certain themes would pop up. So an example would be in New York, there's a really interesting thing where certain food places like Katz's Deli or Jonas Schimmel or Barney's Greengrass become actually the cultural center for a neighborhood. They are the place where people, when they think of their neighborhood, they think of that as quintessential. So a big theme that we wanted to explore was how food becomes a cultural center in New York neighborhoods. And so what we would do is basically say, of all of these examples, which do we think is quintessential to represent that theme? And we would choose by that. So basically, it was we looked at everything, picked out the big themes, and then went back and said, what are the ones that we think are just quintessentially representative of the theme? Another example is, if you, again, in the New York book, one of the things that you may not think about with New York is that, unlike London, it's a 24/7 city. Like they pride themselves on being open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. If you think about that, that changes the way you design things. It changes the way a city behaves. It really shifts things. And so, again, the idea was to say, well, are there examples where you could just go there and immediately see just how impactful 24/7 is? So I think in that case, we chose a fantastic diner, or Florent, which was a kind of like slightly high-end 24/7 diner that really quintessentially captures the way a business has to run and the way things act when it's 24/7.
Do you think that a different group of people could have looked at New York and London and come up with a different set of themes?
Yes and no. Hopefully there are some things that actually capture the broad strokes of New York in ways that are just like absolutely connected to it. So I actually did believe it or not, the most terrifying thing I've done is we did talk radio in New York on New York. And so I was like, oh God, we're going to have call-ins and people are just going to like tear it to shreds. And what was great is that instead New Yorkers called and they were like, I totally see New York. You know, these are the things, which was great. So some themes are definitely kind of universal. I think any group of people who are going to go out are going to see somewhat different themes. And that's actually part of the point. If you go out and look, you're going to see different things. But the point is that you've looked and you started to think about what these things mean. And there's different takes on those themes. With New York, we were fascinated by dogs. Because, again, it's a really hard city to live in. And yet New Yorkers just are unbelievably focused on how they can actually keep dogs in the city. You know, there's like doggy daycare. There's
I've got one of these stories in my family.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, literally, you would see like, there's actually like limo services for dogs that take people around. And so, and frankly, dogs are actually, in this case, they're also equivalent to the way people deal with kids in New York. Like, they're all sort of kind of somewhat similar. And it's like, how do you actually take care of things in an environment that's actually hard to take care of things? These kinds of things are the sort of things that we look at. But you'll see different stuff, but they still might relate to bigger themes, which is, how does a New Yorker take care of things in a city that's hard to take care of things that are precious to us?
You divide us into observers, diners, shoppers, and minglers. I was just curious, are those standard categories in any way that you use in your work, or did these just work for the books?
We actually often will do projects that are actually focused on one of those categories. So we might actually work with somebody who thinks does a lot of shopping. You know, like it may actually be about retail, or it may be about public spaces, things like that. So in some ways, it definitely relates to our work. But the reason we did it is that we all explore, but we all explore in different ways. And you may not think about it, but people who like to shop a lot, they're not just shopping, they're actually exploring the world. We know that about diners, right? Going out to eat is one way to tap into local culture. It's a way to kind of understand things. And we kind of believe that different people have maybe different things that they prioritize when they're traveling. Like, I have friends who are consummate diners. That's the way they want to experience, you know, Paris when they go to Paris, or New York when they go to New York. But that's not just about eating. It's about seeing. It's about kind of understanding New York. There are some people who they love to see, you know, Chicago by drinking, you know, so it's like they're gonna hit every bar, but they're gonna see a very different part of Chicago, but they're gonna see Chicago nonetheless.
And I guess in some ways you're sort of giving permission to do that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is that they're all, I think, equally valid ways of looking. I love shopping as a way to understand things, because you get really interesting perspective on what matters in that market. You get to talk to really interesting people, and then you get to take something home with you. So they're all equal, but the reality is they give you different insight. And I think that the point is to give yourself permission to go whole hog if you want to.
In the London book of Eyes Open, there's an interesting little sketch of something called Havend. Tell me about it.
It's actually really interesting. I mean, we know the way that art plays out in cities, and we think of kind of public art as kind of very big things often, or very kind of impactful things, and they are. What we loved about Havend is really, it's a small artist vending machine that sells a certain work at any given moment. So when we were there, they were actually selling a sound artist's kind of sound sculptures that were these little tiny CDs, and I think you could buy them for £1, you know, which is equivalent to $2. But what we loved about it was a very kind of in-market, very intimate, almost domestic scale way of engaging with art in the city that we just thought was a really interesting take on the way art plays out. And London, as you know, they're both very art-focused cities, but when you think of things like the Tate, where art is at this massive scale, you know, like some of the biggest installations you've ever seen happen in the Tate Gallery, it's really nice to say, well, hey, wait, but it's also happening at this very intimate scale. And it kind of tells you something about the ways that what matters.
You've just mentioned, assuming you were referring to the Tate Modern, one of maybe my all-time favorite interiors of a building. Oh, is that not a stunning place?
What's great about the Tate Modern is that you walk across the bridge and like everyone's using the outside. So like now there's this big thing, parkour, where like people like are like running all over buildings and bridges, and everyone uses the Tate Modern to do that. So you see all this interesting stuff, and then you go in and I don't know, 30% of the people are there to see the art, and you know, the rest of the people are just there to kind of sit down, have a rest, basically just kind of like lying in that great hall. It's like, it's an amazing space. It really is. And it allows you to do art at a scale that we just don't get to see things at the same scale.
I love the vast emptiness of it. It's really just a breathtaking, breathtaking place. Let me ask you this, Fred, what did you learn from producing these two books, Eyes Open for London, Eyes Open New York, that urban leaders can learn from? What can we generalize from these books about cities and about the way cities ought to be made?
One is that local matters, which is actually that that what happens at the local level actually has huge impact on kind of creating really remarkable experiences in design. And I don't just mean a city, but I mean like the neighborhoods in the city. So one of the things that, you know, we love about, you know, London and New York is that each neighborhood acts like its own thing and they create their own things. And so for me, one of the big things to think about in this kind of era where we think a lot about globalization and, you know, this kind of universalism and, you know, that there's like global brands and, you know, the kind of master planning, things like that, is that actually local is incredibly significant. And you make really remarkable things when you think about the local constraints. And I guess that's the second piece, which is designing to constraints, I think actually can make better experiences than tearing those constraints out. You know, so I was in Shanghai, and the way that they're responding to kind of urbanization there is basically tearing out neighborhoods and replacing them with new neighborhoods. You know, so they're like take this out and put in the new ones. And the reality is that the older parts where they've actually tried to build into the constraints of what was there, the kind of old infrastructure, make far more dynamic, interesting, beautiful cities. And I actually think it's something we have to think about as we kind of get to our next cycle of building in cities and think about densification. Does that mean that we tear things out and put new things in, or do we actually build within the frameworks that are there? I certainly think we definitely will get more exciting, more interesting experiences if we work with the constraints that those cities provide, I think.
If you could design a project that a client walked in and gave you about cities and said, "Fred, figure this out for us," what would that project look like?
You know, one of the things that I think about a lot is that, and Chicago is a really interesting example, which is that I think in the U.S. at least, the civicness has kind of fallen away. Chicago is one of the only really invested city that's really invested in the idea of civic spaces and how things can become kind of like public service spaces. And I actually think there's a really interesting thing about rethinking public space now with the ways people behave now and thinking about how we could actually develop far more dynamic, far more useful public spaces that are kind of public amenities. Another example, just from, because I just came back from China, but if you're in Hong Kong, there's a park, Victoria Park, and you go there in the evenings and there's pavilions all over the parks. And in each pavilion, there's a different class happening. There's people doing, you know, dance classes and, you know, exercise classes. And you go at night and it's like this incredibly active place. And it struck me, I was like, oh, this is a park, but it really acts like the community center. You know, it's like, and you think about all the community centers we designed that are terrible places. And I was like, here's this phenomenal community center, but it, you know, it's really a park. So I think thinking about new ways of designing civic spaces to kind of better serve densification and the new ways that we live is a really exciting thing.
Sounds like a good project to me. Fred, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Fred Dust is the author of two books, IDEO Eyes Open, New York and London. That's it for this week's show. But if you want more Smart City, go to our website, smartcityradio.com. There you can listen to archive shows, read the blog, or sign up for our weekly newsletter. You can also reach us by clicking on the contact button or sending an email to questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.